welcome back, friends. Today we're going to talk about episode 3 of Under the Banner of Heaven. We're starting to get a little more complex stories. We're going to get some interesting historical flashbacks again tonight. And so, let's talk about it.
First of all, I'm too busy eating the Cinnamon Toast Crunch milkshake you just made for me. Something Brian picked up on one of our many adventures. This one, South Dakota?
This we bring back from South Dakota.
It's a special milkshake that only Brian makes that if you're ever in his inner circle, you'll know that you won if you've had one of Brian's Cinnamon Toast Crunch milkshakes.
It's the milkshake mighty and strong, so.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So let's talk about this whole angle of the investigation with looking up the canyon in the mountains. Was that part of the actual investigation?
Like directly looking at the canyon, no. But this idea that there were fundamentalists living in the mountains is a real thing. Do you want to talk about why?
Hit me.
So I'll just say this. There's a collective of Mormon fundamentalist patriarchs that were interacting with the Lafferty family that had ties to, let's just say, mountain abodes in Utah.
And that, of course, like we talked about in the lead-up episode, that site of Crossfield's sanctuary was chosen by Revelation. So obviously that the mountains to them were very important. And it's such a good dramatic device because it really... Taba running through that and that tension that it builds is really fantastic.
So, of course, what you're referring to is in episode 3, which we are talking about tonight, we have one of the brothers played by Rory Culkin, who has this sort of standoff with the government at this mountain abode. And that is not exactly accurate. There are some things that were pulled from that narrative that are based in fact. So we do know that several of the brothers at certain times, especially during this time period, decided to live off the grid. We know Mormon fundamentalists who do this a lot. It's, you know, some don't want any reliance on the government at all or the outside world. So they'll live off of generators, their own power supplies. And this is us being brought into the Lafferty world of a brother who is radicalized so far he's off the grid. Now, the Lafferty family did have a farm and a cabin. They called it the farm. It was an old, a rundown barn or property that belonged to the family where the brothers would meet and sometimes live. And so this was sort of an amalgamation of that to show that. It also is pulling on these themes of what happens when constitutionalists radicalize. So a lot of people said that scene reminds them of Ruby Ridge. There's a reason that that's the case. There are Mormon ties to Ruby Ridge that a lot of people don't realize. One of the lead negotiators was a Mormon man that they brought in because he had a lot of high respect and regard.
A very interesting brief Mormon man.
Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, Mr. Bogreitz. He was an interesting one. And he just happened to be a casualty of a fascinating crackdown on kind of right-wing elements of Mormonism in the 90s, the early 90s. And that was... fasting because it happened during the time when Ezra Taft Benson, of all people, was president of the LDS Church, who, of course, had been quite known for his ties to the John Birch Society and conservative politics. By that point in his life, his health and mental state are not great, so it seems very likely that he's not the one making those decisions. But it was used as a way to kind of slap down the more conservative elements and say, oh, look, This is not welcome anymore. And Bo Greitz is part of this whole thing. And he runs for president and gets a decent showing in Utah, at least. Not so much elsewhere. But
well, I mean, you still have these strains like the Bundy family who are mainstream LDS, who have a standoff with the government, considered domestic terrorists, right? You know, actually serving prison time for these kind of things. There are all these ties. Ruby Ridge, for example, there's also another Mormon tie. Randy Weaver's wife was born Community of Christ.
Interesting.
So she had a Mormon background. And yeah, a lot of these people in these constitutionalist struggles have Mormon ties or Mormon fundamentalist ties. And standoffs with the government were common at this time too. We have the Singer Swap standoff, which started with John Singer up in Marion, Utah, where he had a standoff over homeschooling his kids in the late 1970s because he didn't want his kids to be indoctrinated by the public schools and be taught that, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. was a hero. It was this war against civil rights and white supremacy, and he was not about to have his white Mormon kids be taught these things. He grew up as a Hitler youth and, you know, came over to the United States and ends up getting caught in Mormon fundamentalism and has a standoff with the government, leads to an FBI agent being killed. Sorry, to John Singer being killed and becomes a martyr. And then later on, 8 years later, his son-in-law, Adam Swap, stands off with the government again and blows up a stake center with dynamite. So even though this element isn't quite accurate to the Lafferty story, there are elements that are true that investigators had to work with, you know, kind of extreme brothers. I think there's a lot of questions on the traps that they use, like the nails and buckets, the rocks and buckets.
And we keep showing berries and everything.
Yeah, so that's an off-the-grid thing. A lot of people forage, you know, when you're off-the-grid. That was an idea. And especially, this was meant to show how hard of times some of the Lafferty brothers had fallen on, even though, like I said, it's not quite an accurate narrative.
I have to say that the actor playing Jenny in that scene just...
The child actor? Oh, my gosh.
Absolutely knocked it out of the park. She was so good. And that made me think, do we know anything about how the Lafferty kids experience this whole period?
I think it just depends on the family. I mean, I've talked to Dan's daughter, Rebecca, who she's amazing. We should probably have her come on and talk about it too. Yeah, I think it just depended on the family. I talked to one family member who said it was really fun. Like the extremism was kind of fun as a kid because you were forced to get really creative. You know, they have good memories of foraging and fishing and hunting and that kind of thing.
Sarah Weaver, when she talks about living up at Ruby Ridge, it's a very idyllic childhood that she describes.
Yeah, there's a simpleness to it. And there's a, you know, when you're living off the grid, there's this community element where you have to depend heavily on the people around you. And so if those people are kind, it can be a good experience. Dan's family and Ron's family, where the abusive elements start to show up, especially later on, were less than pleasant times, I think. But that doesn't mean that there weren't some good times had as well.
And we get another one of Taba's great lines in here when Sarah very seriously asks if Pyrie keeps all of his covenants. Taba says, he probably does, actually. Gil Birmingham just does such a good job with those kind of understated straight man lines.
What I like about Andrew's performances in these early ones is, like when Taba says something about, he mentions race, and Jeb Pyrie is like, what? How dare you suggest that race was involved? That Mormon defensiveness, you can see that. And when Jeb is talking about a satanic panic, I think that's funny too. He's very like sincerely being like, what if it's Satan worshipers? It's probably Satan worshipers. He captures that. And I think Gil's performance as that allows that sort of innocence to be even more amplified, because you see through Taba's expressions like, oh, brother, I have to watch my mouth again, because that's what matters here is language.
Language, please. And Sarah's performance, I thought, also was fantastic. Do we have a sense for how any of the, you know, Dan's wife, how Matilda, how Diana, do we get a sense of any of them that kind of get radicalized along with the brothers?
So I believe that Matilda's name is a pseudonym, and I think it was a pseudonym in the book to protect her, which I think we're just going to honor. Yeah, I think it's hard for some of these people who are innocent and victims of this to be like re-victimized. I think that I'll just say this, based on Dan's interviews with Lance and based on other interviews with family members and Brenda's journals, I think there was an element of a sort of, I hate to use this term, but like battered woman aspect of hers, she was married to a narcissistic psychopath, right? And that had an effect on her. We'll just say it that way.
And I thought also one of the fascinating elements that we see getting developed through these episodes is the relationship that Brenda starts to form with her sisters-in-law. And obviously the scene with Matilda where they're talking about how to run the business, but then it morphs into spiritual things. Do we have any other ideas of how those relationships, those real life relationships developed?
Yeah, so this was an element that was really important to Lance, but also especially important to the other executive producer, Anna Culp. Anna Culp is really great. She did the Dan Brown movies early on in her career, and she's just an incredibly accomplished filmmaker. And so it was important to her to show the sisterhood between these women, because in patriarchal structures, the sisterhood is what helps women survive. And so it might be complicated, but you really do see the sisterhood start to develop. And unfortunately, because of time constraints, I think that the script had it fleshed out a lot more. These women had a lot more independent lives, but it's sort of still, you get a sense of it, that these connections happen. And this is part of the issue that leads ultimately to Brenda's death. It was not that she was this pretty flirt, like they think in episode one. It's because she had developed the sisterhood and she was determined to help find justice for her sister-in-laws and also help them escape the abuse. She was one of the good Mormons where, you know, abuse too often in our communities covered up and enabled. And Brenda wasn't about to have that. She knew that her sister-in-laws deserved better, and that ultimately led to her death, her murder.
Well, with that, now we have to transition to the scene in the temple.
The temple, dun dun dun.
Oh boy, the one that...
the thing that might get me excommunicated.
Man, that one caused some buzz.
Baby, what else can I do? If you want the moon, I'll bring the moon right down to you. Baby, baby, what else can I do? Someday we'll live in a...
First off, I will say that it's often just out of the gate described as gratuitous. And that, to me, I thought, no.
Is it described that way by anyone that saw it? Or because I believe that was... from the trailer clip, everybody lost their minds before the episode even came out. It was in the trailer and people were like preemptively enraged.
And, you know, you could make a case, I would say, with some stories or whatever of a portrayal of the endowment being gratuitous. However, with this story, no. I would argue that this is very much germane.
Again, we didn't do anything that wasn't public record. The church has been very transparent in the last few years with their temple clothes and the purpose of their endowment. And gratuitous, I mean, I don't even know what that means in this context. We're showing a Mormon ritual and ceremony, and we didn't... Okay. I'll calm down my defensiveness for a minute. This is a very personal topic for me because it was by far the hardest scene for me to work on. I'm an endowed member, which means I had my own endowment out, and I took covenants and oaths that I promised to never reveal. That's part of the gig in the temple. You take these oaths that you promise to never reveal. And I will say, I kept that covenant. I did not take the oath that is shown on the show, not because it's not accurate to history, but it's because by the time I went through the temple in the late or early 2000s, that oath was taken out of the temple. Do you want to talk about that for a minute and then we can get into the depictions?
Yes. And one quick aside for our non-Mormon listeners. Lindsay mentioned that an oath to not divulge certain things. That covers very specific things. That is a very small part of this ritual endowment drama. However, in Mormon culture, almost universally, that is amplified into a... implicit,
can't talk about anything.
Yes, implicit, yeah. If not explicitly, nothing is talked about, period.
Which is part of the problem. In my own temple experience, we had a course before you go to the temple. So you're not... temple for outsiders, here's how it goes. You do not go into the temple until you're 18, 19 years old, typically. There are
at
cases
least.
Of people going in a little earlier, but they are very special cases. And if you're 12 and over, you can go and do baptisms for the dead in a separate wing of the temple. It's usually in the basement, where you perform a ritual where you are baptized on behalf of the dead. You act as a proxy for someone who has died, so that in Mormon belief, in the next life, in the spirit world, you can accept the gospel. Well, a lot of people have been asking us since the show, so does that mean Mormons are getting baptized for me when I die? Yes, that's exactly what it means. If we get your name, we're baptizing you whether you want to be or not. And this has gotten us into some problems. Do you want to say anything about that?
Very specifically, and this is a case of Mormon zeal kind of getting ahead of themselves. Folks were getting baptized for Holocaust victims. As you might expect, that did not go over super well. That was seen as incredibly offensive, and this is hard because Mormons really, I think, genuinely don't understand the reactions of people who find this offensive, because in Mormon eyes, it's seen as this very giving, service. That's the word I want. It's a service. And so others who definitely don't see it that way, that's.
You know, in the first three episodes, there are moments of anti-Semitism or, you know, not jokes, lines about Hitler or Jews. And a lot of Mormons are like embarrassed that was included, but this is absolutely an issue. I mean, the fact that Hitler has been baptized for the dead shows that what we're essentially saying,
not just once,
in Mormon practice is that Hitler can be redeemed, which I don't know, that's maybe a beautiful Christian idea, but it's so unevenly applied in Mormon doctrine. I mean, you have Mormons being excommunicated for wanting to give priesthood to women, for example. But like, Hitler is going to be in a higher degree of glory than Kate Kelly, who was excommunicated. It's just like, I don't love that. And Elvis his work has been done.
Well, he did read the Book of Mormon, you know.
I mean, you should look at the list of people Mormons have baptized. It's kind of, it's
literally
kind of
everyone.
Everyone except for, there is the case to be made that Mormons long ago, this is something I didn't know as a member, that we ran out of names. And so they would just like recycle the names. I didn't know that they did that for a long time. And I all through junior high, from the time I turned 12 till I was 18, I went almost every single Wednesday to do baptisms for the dead. So that's one thing you do in the temple. But the other thing you do is you go when you're about to go on a mission, if you're a boy usually, or about to get married as a girl. Now it can be both for men and women, and you get out your endowment. Do you want to explain what that is really quick?
Yes. So you have a couple things that are part of that. First, you have a ritual washing and anointing with oil that are frequently called the initiatory ordinances that are accompanied by promises and things like that. Then there is this ritual drama that takes place called the endowment that incorporates a story of the creation of the world and Adam and Eve, and kind of this ritual history of mankind type of thing that involves these ritual promises also of certain covenants that are made to obey certain principles, and that some very specific elements of that are associated with oaths not to divulge that.
And this usually happens right before you get married. So in the episode 3, it is shown as part of Brenda's wedding ceremony, essentially. And so we can talk about that, because that was an interesting distinction to explain to people when I got on set, because most people thought we were filming Brenda's wedding. But as a Mormon, they're very separate. Even though, like, for example, my endowment, I got my endowment out, I think, 2 days before my wedding. Some people do it the day of their wedding. So it's very like, you get out your endowment, go through that ceremony, and then you go right in and you're sealed. Which also takes place in the temple. So in this series, we're showing an oath and covenant, you know, this blood oath, basically, where you ritualistically slice your own throat. That was done and taken out in 1990. Do you want to talk about that oath really quick, the history of it?
Yeah, it's interesting because the endowment begins in the time of Joseph Smith. And then once he dies and Brigham Young takes over, there are other elements that are part of it. One of those that had been taken out even earlier was an oath of vengeance against those that had killed Joseph Smith. So the endowment, nearly from the beginning, had some very violent overtones to it.
And I will say most fundamentalist ceremonies keep both of those oaths in.
And so this other element of it that you would essentially cut your own throat before you would reveal, before you divulge this, these secrets that you're given. Not surprisingly, you know, in a modern context, became very out of place.
Well, and we didn't even show, I mean, it involves ritualistically disemboweling yourself. Like, it's a very sort of graphic oath. I'm so glad I didn't have to take it, but that made it easier for me to work on the scene. So I'll just talk about that for a minute. The research we did to get that room was pretty intense. Renee Reed and her research team are pretty great. In fact, when I first walked on set, it was my first day on set, and I walked into the temple. It was built inside a warehouse, a film studio warehouse up in Calgary. So it's cold outside. You know, I think it was October or November when I had gone up. I think it was October when I'd first gone up, and it was cold. And so I'm wearing like street clothes. You know, I brought my temple clothes so we could compare. And I walked in, and I can't explain what that feeling was like.
The work involved in creating that specific set was unbelievable.
So one detail that is off in the temple, and it was deliberately so, are the murals. I want to keep calling it the garden room because it was a garden room in the script. Because basically, for the temple scene, we're taking different language from several parts of the ceremony and combining them into one room. And the reason why we're doing that is because in the Salt Lake Temple, which is where this takes place, you move from room to room to get different rituals. And it would just have been way too expensive and wasteful to create three different sets to do this in. So this was a recreation of the telestial room. The telestial, I can't get those two straight. I honestly can't. The telestial room, and the murals are not exactly accurate because of legal reasons. So all the art are replications to avoid copyright, and same with the murals in that room.
That will come up in a very touchy subject way here very soon.
So but the room was similar. The carpet's the same. The chairs are the same. And so I talked about this in Steven Pinecker's show, but it was really overwhelming. So I go in, and my job is to help lock the scene, which means we tell the actors where to stand. We show what's going to happen. We sort of practice before they start to direct the actual and film the actual scene. And so I'm there in the And the director of the scene is Courtney, and she's Courtney Hunt, and she's Catholic. And so for her, it was really hard to figure out which part of the ritual was like ritualistic and ritualized, because for her experience, and that's why when you see the washing and anointing, Brenda's arms are out, because for her, like when I said, you put your arms kind of out, you know, and I didn't think to specifically say like, you
just, how far?
Yeah. And I have since talked to people that said that they put theirs out, so I think it's fine. But that's just an example where a Catholic, you know, that would have been ritualized maybe in their sort of landscape of rituals. So I walk into the scene, and all the women come out, and they're in their robes and hair and makeup, and they're in their garments, which to them are costumes.
Now, this is a point, because when you talked about that with Steve, I thought we need to explain that, because again, to non-Mormons, all of this is what in the world is going on here. So as part of these initiatory ordinances, this washing and anointing, you are given a garment. And what this is essentially underwear that has been marked in a special way that sort of ties in with what's going on in this ritual drama that's being. And then after.
Your underwear is literally part of the drama.
Yes.
That's, I mean, you're not in your underwear. You're in your underwear, but you've got other clothes on too.
Yes.
For most of it.
And then you wear.
Weird to say.
You know, you wear this kind of underwear, you know, that you own for the rest of your life, right? But again, that's underwear. So when Lindsay says she's there and these people come out in their garments, imagine if you go to a set and people just walk out in bra and panties, and you're like...
In the temple.
And you're like, whoa, hold on. But I think I know why that happened. It's because in the book, Krakauer talks about them being in their garments. Because this distinction between what is garments and what's temple clothes.
Well, they had temple clothes. They just hadn't put them on yet, because my job was to explain where you put, because they didn't know which parts of the temple you put the clothes on in, right? So they're like ready to put on these costumes. And for me, growing up as a Mormon, seeing this only as underwear, it was like, being there with naked people. I was just like, where do I look? I don't know where to look. It was so strange. And of course, to them, like, it was just very like, this is the costume we're wearing. And meanwhile, the men did have on, I think they had on most of their temple clothes. I think I would have remembered. It's all a blur now, but I think I would have remembered if they were just in their garments. That would have been very traumatic for me. But that was an experience in and of itself, to see all these bearded Lafferty's, and they looked like Lafferty's for this scene. At least when we first shot it. And I was just like, what is happening? Dan Lafferty's sitting there. It was very overwhelming. I joke about this, but this is the strangest moment, hands down, of my life ever. And that's saying a lot. I study Mormon fundamentalism. I've seen some things. But to talk to Rory Culkin about blood atonement in the temple for 20 minutes was not something I saw on my bingo card for life.
And that's another point where we probably ought to do a quick tangent and just very briefly talk about this concept of blood atonement. So this is one that, again, ties in very directly to this case. So as we mentioned, the hand motion that's done there that you see in that scene, part of that is essentially slashing your throat from ear to ear. And the reason that this is important is during the 19th century, you have this concept of what's called blood atonement that is occasionally preached by church leaders, notably Brigham Young. And it's the idea is basically that there are certain sins that are so heinous that the atonement of Jesus Christ will not cover it. And so you essentially have to atone for that yourself. Well, eventually that kind of morphs into the idea that you should do that to someone else if they have committed that sin. And so you get this
and that morphing doesn't take long, actually, because this is a frontier Utah doctrine. And we, you know, mainstreamers want to say that it was never part of the canon, but you have a prophet saying it over the pulpit multiple times to many different audiences. It's part of the canon when that happens.
And part of that, too, is it's argued that this was strictly rhetorical. The problem is you have cases, and the number of cases is hotly debated, but it's cases where it seems like you have folks who are acting in a defender of the faith role who are, and somebody else said it was weird to see blood atone as a verb. And I thought, that comes up
in every now 1860s and again. Utah, that was just the way that justice happened. You know, Thomas Coleman's lynching, he was a black man who had the misfortune of being a servant in the Hotel Utah and in Brigham Young's household at some times in a particularly contentious time. He was found blood atoned with a note pinned to his skin, blaming it on a racial lynching. You have Mormons being blood atoned. That happened. You have Mormons being castrated by other Mormons. This is a violent time in which this doctrine is sort of born. And you can argue it's metaphor all you want, but that is not how it always came into being. And that's the problem with these Mormon doctrines. You can't teach a people to be so literalistic, but then on the bad stuff, be like, no, then not that one.
No, this that is was metaphor. A metaphor. This is metaphor. And so the summary of that is the idea of blood atonement is that there are certain sins that are so bad, and sometimes that becomes others blood atoning someone else, the physical mechanism being slitting their throat. And so that's why, you know, it was argued that this temple scene was gratuitous, is where we're pushing back, saying because of how these murders happened, because of the background of them, we would argue that not only is it not gratuitous, that to not include that would actually be leaving out a very important aspect of this case.
People say, aren't you worried about getting excommunicated for that? If I got excommunicated for depicting that, so be it. I mean, that oath is monstrously bad. It has led to bad things. I don't know what good things it's led to. Let's argue that case. It deserved to be gone. It deserved to be taken out. And it's very germane to this story. And again, back to this literalism, going through the temple in the early 2000s when I did, we had our temple sealer tell us on our wedding day that if we went every single week, our marriage would not fall apart. He must have been right, because it eventually did. But we did that for the first 2.5 years of our marriage. We tried to go almost every single week unless we were traveling, and I developed panic attacks over time. I didn't realize it at the time. I thought it was Satan trying to tempt me not to go. But I developed an OCD around the temple because I'm left-handed. I'm dyslexic. I struggle with right and left. I just always have my whole life. And so to get up there and follow these rituals, I literally believed, and there was nothing in my life to tell me otherwise, that if I didn't memorize all these oaths and handshakes and signals perfectly, I was not going to be with my family forever. And so some people can argue that the temple covenants are metaphors. That is not my experience, and that is not the experience of many, many people. And I think is still lacking from the discourse.
And critically, the argument that's made is that it was not, that's not how it was seen by the Laffertys. And that's why it's germane here. And this is a, this, because it depicted this very specific part of the endowment drama, it's going to raise some interesting questions from people who are, because that, what that specific element of the drama was removed in 1990, people will see that and say, well, that didn't happen. And then we'll perhaps learn later that it did in fact happen and was very much a part of what these people would have experienced.
And it is part of Dan Lafferty's theology. He will argue that it is. He ties this temple ritual to this killing and to Brigham Young, and there's precedent for it. As ugly as that is, Mormons just own it. We don't do it anymore, most of us. We had a thing where some fundamentalists argued that it was a metaphor, but Moroni Jessup, who's a Mormon fundamentalist, said, I just think Brigham was wrong. And I just was clapping when he said that. Like, yes, that's what we need to do. That was wrong. It was just wrong. Sorry what that says about the rest of your belief system. You can figure that out. But he was wrong about this, and it needs to go.
That's the scene. That was, I remember that when you told me that was going to be in the series, I thought, oh boy, that's going to create some buzz.
I will say, though, the buzz, since then, most people who have seen it say that it was respectfully done. And it was. We did that on purpose. We didn't reveal anything that would be sacred. We showed what was germane to the story. We didn't mock it. There was some angst over the fact that the women were talking to each other in the temple. And I can tell you, I know from personal experience that women aren't allowed to talk in the temple. And you know how you find that out? Because you talk in the temple.
And you get shushed.
That's how it happens. And so when we first did it, like I said, there was this misunderstanding that they thought it was going to be this wedding scene where she walks in and it's only her family. And so we actually had to reschedule the shoot, which never happens because Lance was so committed to getting it right. I mean, you got to understand the smallest things were off and Lance shut down the whole production so we could get it right. It was that important to him. Who knows how much money that cost them that day. But at first they thought it was going to be this wedding scene. And I said this on Stephen Pinecker too. That was one of those moments where you realize how weird your faith is when I'm saying Brenda actually sits in the front, not by her family. Her family sits behind her because this whole first row is for the brides going through. And they're like, brides? But it's plural. Brenda's wedding. And I was like, yeah, it's
not
the,
yet.
All the brides go through on this row and all the missionaries on this side. And it was this moment where I'm like, oh, this is why people think Mormons are crazy. Because we have a row for all the brides that we mass produce all through each session, you know? That's a weird thing. It's kind of weird.
I imagine for non-Mormon watchers, that scene had to have been very interesting.
And the one thing that they don't have that she should have had is she should have had that little hot pink, card taped to her as her first time going through the temple. But
because again, like proxy baptisms, all of these other people, including her family members that were there that day, would have been going through this whole process as a proxy for someone that had died, that was, that was no longer living. And so that's the rest of this whole room is they're there not for themselves, but for as a proxy.
I mean, I think that if I'm going to be in the Celestial Kingdom with anyone, though, it's going to be Dustin Lance Black, because I basically performed some sort of sealing ceremony with Lance to show him. And so I feel like we're Hollywood sealed now under the authority of Ron Howard.
But in the name of Ron Howard, let it be so.
I'll take Tom as a plural wife. He's a cutie.
Then we get another very important flashback, this time of the episode at Hans Mill. And this one, if you were to pick the crucial point of the Mormon narrative of persecution, that's got to be the one, I would say.
You know, I really appreciated that he included this scene because I think Lance tried to throw bones to Mormons wherever he could. And this was one of those that it was easier to do that. So for the historical scene, this was actually one of the last scenes we shot, even though it ends up in episode 3. So it was one of our final scenes. And it was a really emotional day. You know, they had built sort of on the set this replica of the blacksmith shop. And they had the bellows, they had everything, and they had young child actors. And so it's something to walk around these scenes recreated and you're seeing people who you know their names, Sardius Smith, this 10-year-old kid, he's running around and I'm watching him. So, if you're a child actor, you have to have I forget the name. There's a name that they have with the child actors, like an escort. And so she's with these child actors and they're just being kids, they're just three little boys playing in the dirt. And to realize like what they had to enact, you know, recreate was really interesting. And it was also cool to see the Hollywood magic in the ways that they do it so they're not traumatizing kids. That was really cool to see. Especially also, I'm just going to point this out, with the sex scenes too, you know, which we had very few of, but we did have some nudity scenes. And so Janine Waddell, who's an ex-Mormon up in Calgary, she's an intimacy coordinator. And maybe we should have her on too to talk about her job, because they have these on set to help make sure everyone's autonomy and, you know, consent is respected. So it was very, you know, cool to see how they dealt with the violence of children in this case. It was very respectfully done. But I was in the bellows. I was in the blacksmith shop for that whole scene. I was in there hiding behind the bellows. It was so wild. But that was we took several accounts of the scene and tried to make it as true to history as possible. And I'm pretty proud of it.
And that's an interesting scene. My ancestor was one of those killed there. So that was a very interesting thing to see how that was portrayed. But that is in the historical chronology, that's at the very end of the Missouri period in 1838, where it's really becoming untenable for Mormons to stay anymore. And so unjustly so, Mormons do look at that as a true example of persecution, which it was. I mean, especially when they shoot the kid there, the nits make lice part. I mean, that's inarguably indefensible.
Well, that's one of the critiques from ex-Mormons. They said, why didn't you show, you know, the trouble leading up to it? And I'm like, I feel like we did. We showed that Joseph Smith is accused of being with women and their financial problems. I mean, that's really the gist of it. We didn't have the details. I mean, it is true that Mormons sometimes gave as good as they got. But not those people living there. Those people were paying for the sins of other men like Joseph Smith. They were innocent. Some of them were newly converted. And what that did was that whole thing codified religious zealotry and justified it forever. In fact, if you look at Sardia Smith's family and the story of this woman who loses all these boys, or it cripples them for life, dealing with the wounds of her boys for the rest of her life radicalizes her, radicalizes people that know her. Her boys who are crippled for life are held up as these martyrs almost, and that justifies violence later on. And I'm not saying, like, I'm not trying to justify violence at all. I'm just saying this is how persecution complexes work. That's why they work really well on the show. And I think that we tried to make a lot of efforts to not make Mormons feel persecuted, even though they found ways to feel persecuted anyways, just who we are. It's our mother's milk. But this was a way that we could show that something real and violent happened to them. And this is why they ended up the way that they did.
And we see that play out back at the police station when, I'm trying to remember if it's Alan or Robin that says this, that, well, did Joseph Smith ever resort to violence? I think it's Robin, yeah. And personally, like with his own hands, not so much. But he's part of that brief Missouri period where it gets really ugly.
I mean, he was captain of armies and wearing swords and sabers. He might not have gotten his hands dirty, but he was given orders. We do know that.
And that's, we talked about with on the Sidney Rigdon episodes, is the effect that Sidney Rigdon's rhetoric that was, if not directed, at least condoned by Joseph Smith.
Joseph Smith was in fist fights with his own brother in front of people at church. Like, it wasn't like he was this pure, soft, sweet little innocent man. I mean, and I will say this too. I get so frustrated when people and Mormons are like, this series is trying to say that all Mormons are violent, that it makes violent men. I'm sorry. Patriarchal polygamy is violent. I'm sorry. It is. To my polygamous friends, I don't think that you're all violent men, but I think patriarchal polygamy and coercion is violent. I think that's a violence committed against a gender. It's not okay.
And that's one of the larger, I think, themes that's coming out too, and that it's hidden too often, is an easy out is to say that, well, in my Mormonism, it never leads to killing women. Okay. What does it lead to? What other sorts of violence does it lead to?
I mean, you look at Helen Mar Kimball, okay? Let's bring her up in the Nauvoo period. And so this is one well-documented case. And let's throw all the bones to apologists and say that Joseph Smith didn't have sex with his 14-year-old wife. What we do know for sure, well-documented by many sources, not just the girl, because that's not enough in our community, or a girl's parents who was an apostle in the church. She was traded for eternal salvation for her parents. Her marriage at 14 to Joseph Smith preserved her and prevented her from being around anyone else her age. It literally, what's the word I want? Imprisoned.
Yeah, it takes her out of a normal, fun life.
She's not allowed choice. She's not allowed certain things. That is violent. You don't have to hit someone to hurt them. And Helen Mar was bitter about that her whole life, even as she got into Utah, and she was faithful.
Faithful woman, yep.
This was not an easy thing. And what Joseph Smith did, you could argue was dangerous and manipulative, if not violent, to get her to. He approaches Heber C. Kimball, says, "I want your wife as my wife."
It's just a test, though.
And they agonize over it for a long time, for several days. And they come back contrite and say, "Okay, we'll give it, you know, you can have my wife." And he says, "Just kidding, want your daughter instead." I mean, come on, you guys.
But then that's then later painted as a model of virtue, which is in itself violent.
This is my thing with any Mormon, I don't care what stripe you are, if you are trying to find ways to make that godly, just stop. Don't. Because the message of the show is the same. Fundamentalists are recreating the history. If we have this in the history of a man that we revere, it is going to keep recreating itself over and over and over again. And this is why the Laffertys happened, because Joseph Smith is still revered in all of Joseph Smith, not just the good, but this stuff too. We have to take the bad and make it good. And that's part of the themes of the show, I think.
And an easy out there is to say, well, that's what weirdo fundamentalists do. No. That is not the takeaway. I think Lance's goal on this specific question is to invite a reappraisal of everyone's faith within Mormonism and behavior and practices and all that, to see where these ideas lead to any form of violence, not necessarily physical, but in other ways. And so by painting as this is something that others do, you're taking yourself out of that and you don't have to.
I was thinking of this interview that I listened to with Dan Lafferty. So I've listened to several of his interviews now. And when he talks about the violence against Brenda, it's very casual to him. And his justification is he beat her before he murders her as an act of kindness. And in his mind, he's really saying, I was doing it to save her from further, you know, hurt or harm. He literally beats her over and over. And this idea that there's this like hierarchy of violence and is such a part of Mormon culture. It's part of society, but it's definitely part of patriarchal culture that, you know, hitting a woman isn't so bad. It's ending her life that it's bad. You know what else is bad? Coercing women at 14 into a lifetime commitment with their dad's buddy who's in charge of their religious movement. That's not okay either.
And that's the thing that I think has the reason there's been so much strong response is these are difficult and unpleasant issues to confront. And so it's easier to focus on other things and deflect than to truly engage those ideas.
What's been interesting is to see the reaction to the show. It is triggering a lot of people and bringing a lot out in the open. I've talked to therapist friends who say the intakes are way up, which is great news. Congratulations. Any Mormon that's out there getting therapy right now, 7 snaps of heaven for you. This is amazing. This is exactly what you should be doing. Everyone that can have access and afford therapy should get it. And if not, contact me. I try to help get people the help that they need whenever we can, because it's important. But it's opening up these wounds for people. And I have to say, it's done that for me as well. I have had to confront some things in my own Mormonism that have been very uncomfortable. And one of them is this idea that I still find myself talking. I pin everything on Brigham Young. And you know why I do that? Because I still don't want to indict Joseph Smith. I still have that in me. To me, he is this Christ-like figure. He's beautiful and calm and sweet. I still, even when talking about his polygamy, I want to give it dignity for the women's sake, but it's partially to protect Joseph Smith. Because if I have to admit what he did is wrong, then it's forcing me to look at a whole pattern of stuff that I've let be okay my whole life and in our community. And that is not something that anyone can look at easily.
It's a thread we don't want to pull on too much.
And I'm surprised because you'd think, you know, I did a year of polygamy. I processed this hundreds of times over. And yet it still takes seeing my own faith sort of startlingly, like glaringly, embarrassingly on screen like that to be like, oh, that's not okay. So it is a mirror. And I think that that's one of the beautiful things of the series. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't want to look in the mirror. They want to look at the new era covers of Mormon history. And that's not good.
Yeah.
Sorry, we went on quite the tangent.
You got on a little one there.
It's your Cinnamon Toast Crunch milkshake.
Let's go back now and talk about the interview before baptism, because I think, again, especially for non-Mormon watchers, this will be kind of curious. So we talked earlier in episode 2, I believe, the idea that Mormons, rather than doing infant baptism, will do baptisms at the age of 8 as a minimum. And so part of that is that it involves more of a kind of a conscious choice to do that, which, yes, but 8-year-olds generally tend to not have a great grasp of theological principles and lifetime requirements and things of that nature. But anyways, what that involves is an interview with the bishop, the leader of your local congregation. And that's such an interesting scene because you already see Jeb starting to wonder out loud about things. And that's, I think probably the first noticeable time where he's really wrestling.
Yeah, I think that that's, it's in a place of confession, right? So what happens in the bishop's office is theoretically supposed to stay in the bishop's office. Rarely does it, but that's sort of the premise. And so that is where Jeb can go and be vulnerable. Now, the criticism is that we did the baptism interview with the parents in the room. There are a few reasons why we did that. One of them, the main one, was we talked to enough cops, Mormon cops, who said that they, like, because of their work, always, you know, go with their kids. There's been a recent movement to have more parents in the rooms of the bishopric, thanks to activists about, you know, with sexual abuse and stuff like that, because there have been too many cases of clergy alone with children, Mormon clergy alone with children, and it leads to abuse or other inappropriate behaviors, asking graphic sexual questions. Some of it, I mean, I feel like I'm defending it. I just want to explain it, but maybe what's the difference? I mean, I think when Mormon bishops have no sexual boundaries and don't have good sexual narratives, they don't even realize it's inappropriate to ask an 8-year-old if they're keeping the law of chastity. Well, but it does happen to some people.
And this goes to later when, you know, after this, where he's talking to the bishop, and this goes to the idea that Mormon bishops can receive and deal with all sorts of issues, right? Because of the mere fact that they are a bishop.
Yeah, you're supposed to be almost omniscient when you're a bishop. You're supposed to be a marriage counselor, a therapist, a tax advisor, a criminal lawyer. Like, it's
employment.
You can go and confess anything, right? Yes. Apparently a pharmacology
expert.
Literally
any problem you're having in your life. And obviously, because the Mormon system, rather than a trained paid clergy, operates on the volunteer appointed position, you know, the man who's appointed to be the bishop is just one of your neighbors with, you know, he may have some training in something just by way of his occupation, but he probably doesn't.
Yeah. And so, yes, we left the parents in for the bishop. I stand by that. I think it's fine. There is a protocol. And at the time they weren't having parents and they weren't asking sexual questions, but that doesn't mean that those things weren't happening. There is diversity in Mormon practice. Remember, like Brian said, you got your neighbor applying a handbook. There are various interpretations. So they do the baptism interview. Those questions are pretty on par. The answers are on par. You just obediently say yes to everything. The mother is complimented on her work for sewing the dresses. And then we have Jeb confessing to the bishop. And here we see him try to be vulnerable. It's interesting. He is not even allowed to talk about his real issue with his mother. He's starting to have a concern about her mortality. And the bishop just takes it to suicide, to death, right? It's just this idea that it must be about that, about ending a life. And Jeb was like, no, that's not quite where I was going. But okay. Do you want to say anything about that?
Not necessarily. I do want to play a game of two mundanes and one serious, however.
Okay.
My first mundane is a general mundane, the decor of the office, because you told me how that played out, which I found very entertaining.
Okay, so talk about that. Listen, I tried, Mormons. I tried to do our people well and tell everyone, tell the world how bad our taste is. I really did. I said, listen, this is too fancy. We need smaller rooms.
What's in that room?
Less fluffy chairs.
Is there
cinder
a couch?
Blocks that are painted. Can you do that for us? Like, I will save you so much money on your set design. But Renee Reed and her team had an aesthetic that they, you know, there's, do you really want to look at white cinder block
a
all the
real
time?
Mormon bishop's office is incredibly
boring. You guys,
boring.
You haven't lived until you've had to tell a group of like expert, top-notch interior designers what carpet on the wall is for, okay?
Scratchy carpet at that.
It's for handprints. Yeah, so the office is big. It is robust. There are things in it that would not be in the bishop's office. I tried. Lost out on that one. Probably for the best.
Some of those things in that office you would find pictures of LDS church leaders.
When everyone's like, you're trying to make Mormons look bad, I'm like, no, Renee made you look way better than your aesthetic. What do you feel about purple carpet, maroon walls?
I hadn't and probably wouldn't have noticed this had you not pointed it out to me, so I blame you. But behind on the wall are pictures of some earlier LDS
Why
church leaders.
Name them.
Let's see. We got
Brigham.
You have Joseph too? Yeah, Joseph Brigham. And then Spencer W. Kimball are very much identifiable. However, in third position, you have someone else.
Elder Sigmund Freud.
Remember the F. This is supposed to be Joseph F. Smith.
Okay, I nixed that one. I don't know how it got through. I swear, they gave me a stack of like portraits and I was like, yes, yes, no, no. Definite no on that. When it came through, I made no after note. It was too late. Every time I see it, I want to be like, Sigmund Freud. I mean, maybe like, this is what I'll tell Mormons. It's a metaphor. It's just a metaphor.
These kinds of
for
things.
For the bishop's office.
Earlier in the scene where they find Jeb's mom and the bus pulls up, you pointed out that somebody alerted you to the fact that the logo on the bus
came a year later.
Came a year later.
The UTA got their official yeah.
If you don't think that Mormons, and I guess that one doesn't necessarily have to be a Mormon, but are watching very carefully.
Genealogy. We are doing it. And we're very picky about the wrong things.
They talk
we'll
about
be totally fine saying that grandpa only had two wives, right? Not the 17, you know, but you get the UTA logo
Heaven
wrong.
Heaven forbid. Okay, now to my serious point of this interview. The bishop reminds him that the prophet will never lead us astray. And that is a fascinating concept because that phrase has a very specific origin in a very complicated time. So if you remember back to our initial episode where we talked with Dr. Christina Rossetti about the history of fundamentalism, we talked about the manifesto in 1890 from Church President Wilford Woodruff, ostensibly to end polygamy. As we talked about, it is 50 times more complicated than that. But at that general conference of the church in October 1890, when that manifesto is presented and then voted on in a very ho-hum, lackluster type of way, he tells his listeners the following. He says, "The Lord will never permit me or any other man who stands as president of this church to lead you astray. It is not in the program. It is not in the mind of God. If I were to attempt that, the Lord would remove me out of my place, and so he will any other man who attempts to lead the children of men astray from the oracles of God and from their duty."
One of the most helpful bits of advice that has screwed up so many people for generations.
As we talked about, that specific day that he says those words is a very complicated day, because it is on that day, according to Mike Quinn's research, that Wilford Woodruff, in private, signs, recommends so that people can enter into plural marriages in Mexico.
And what year is this again, Brian?
This is 1890.
1890, the year that all truth was lost in Mormonism, if you're a Mormon fundamentalist. Go back and listen to the first part of the series. Brian and Christina Rossetti talk about this struggle.
So yeah, the phrase, the prophet will never lead you astray. Boy, does that have a fun history. So,
but it is something that is perpetuated. How many times did you hear that growing up? I heard it all the time. Anytime there was a criticism or a question, a doubt.
Well, where is the easiest place that one might find that statement? Why, within the printed pages of your scriptures. So attached to the text of the manifesto, you have three statements of Wilford Woodruff, giving context to that, that's one of them. Problem is not many people are aware of the incredibly complicated history that stands behind that. So
thanks for that little nugget.
Telling folks that the prophet will never lead you astray, it's a little more complicated than that. Also in that, we get the another one of these things that gets pointed out is using the term congregation as opposed to ward.
Yeah, congregation, ward, that was a translation issue to a larger group. We did, you'll notice ward is used, but I've also noticed it's taking me a few times to watch it till I hear it, because it's so part of my parlance here. It's so interesting.
Yep.
The wrong words stand out a lot easier than the right words do.
Yep. And also in this, and then later, especially as Jeb and Beck are talking about this at home, we see the social pressure that surrounds all of what Jeb is going through start to come to the surface.
Hold on, I want to say one thing, because we didn't talk about the shelf rhetoric either. The bishop says, put yes. your doubts on yes, a shelf, yes. and people are like, he would never say
That's
that.
That's anachronistic.
He would say that. Camilla Kimball.
Spencer's wife?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
She comes out with it just like 2 years before, no, it was the 81 that she starts
using the shelf,
yeah, over the pulpit. And then other leaders do too. So it might have been in the 70s. I'll have to look up the exact date.
That's interesting because that also seems slightly anachronistic, but
nope, it is absolutely based in doctrine. It was something that was used in the parlance of the time. This is why when people try to argue with me about like the dialogue, and I was like, you don't understand the level of research that was put into this.
Trust me,
not just by me, but you have dialect, like our dialect coach, she coached specific people on the demographics, the area, the time period. It's impeccable research. And so it might not ring true to you, but that's because you weren't in East Rockwell, 1984.
Yep. And again, this is, we'll just keep mentioning every time we need to, but just because you didn't see something happening that way doesn't mean that others didn't.
Well, like you said, there are times, I mean, and I've said this too, there's a scene later on with Ron's daughter cutting out symbols of his garments. When I flagged that, because I was like, that's not accurate, that wouldn't happen. It did. It happened. I was wrong.
Real quick here, we're going to get into some things that you're going to definitely think didn't happen and 100% did. So you just hold that thought. But yeah, back to that idea of social pressure. I mean, this is certainly not unique to Mormons, but if someone is excommunicated, if a missionary comes home before his allotted time ends, so many different things result in incredible scrutiny by those around them.
In my own family's case, it was the idea of a mission. If, you know, someone didn't go on a mission, that was a big deal. I remember I got baptized also en masse, just like my wedding, with I think 6 other kids in my ward, and we all shared the same day. And it would have been noticeable if I hadn't been baptized then. I knew when all the summer birthdays were because we celebrated them all together in primary. So all the kids that had birthdays and turned 8 around the time I did were celebrated. And you would know if they didn't get baptized. I knew every kid in my ward who was baptized and who wasn't. That's kind of messed up when you think about it.
So when Becca says, if she's not baptized right now, you know, people will notice. This is an idol. Like, this is a people 100%.
And we cannot stress, you know, I saw a Mormon man, you know, making fun of this scene, talking about this, like, why would this ever happen? He's obviously never been a Mormon woman because the responsibility is placed on the mothers. This is a social status symbol to women, and it's deeply, deeply important. So Rebecca feeling upset about this and betrayed, this is about her whole personhood, her whole role and responsibility in life. And it's going to have real implications for her socially, even if they seem ridiculous to us.
And part of that is just because they frequently aren't voiced out loud as much as they're felt. So while this might not have been said to this particular guy, women in his life definitely were feeling this. So yeah, that's another case where this 100% rings true.
And for Jeb's part, you know, he's clearly struggling with faith. He doesn't know if he can do this. There's this idea, and I've experienced this, you probably have too, where you feel like you maybe aren't worthy enough to participate in an ordinance, because in Jeb's case, he's baptizing his daughters. They're his world. He wants to be in the right headspace and framework, because we believe that if you're not, that Satan can come in and tempt you or lead you astray or throw things off. Jeb doesn't want that for his daughters. Mm-hmm. He wants the best.
And I find it so interesting that in both cases, both he and Becca resort to kind of this default position of the priesthood holder as a way to discuss what's going on. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, that was like, it seems like both, especially Jeb, when he says it, it's not, he doesn't necessarily mean that. It's just, that's kind of what you do in that situation.
Where he like pulls his priesthood card.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's like an instinctual
how many
response.
Times has that been mm-hmm. used? I mean, even women to women, like I've been in so many meetings, planning meetings for like girls camp or young women's where the priesthood card is held. Like we couldn't make a decision. We had to bring in a man. Like the guy who's a plumber is going to know more about what's good for these girls' needs than us who are with them every day. Right. So that happened a lot. And her joke about holding the priesthood, people are like, that's so cringy. That would never happen. You guys, really, come on. I made that joke probably in the bedroom.
Can we assume?
I wish I didn't assume
that Jeb attended BYU. Isn't that a fair assumption? And Becca too, probably.
His haircut, his perfect Mormon haircut would say yes.
Where did they learn that joke? They learned that at BYU. I guarantee it.
If you don't think that joke is funny, it's not the show's fault. Let's just put it that way.
Was it cringy? Yes, of course. That's kind of the point.
Let's go sunning. It's so good for you. Let's go sunning. Neath the sky of blue. Greet the sun every morn. Feel as free and happy as the day you were born.
Okay, now a perversely fun section of tonight's episode. Dan for sheriff. Oh, wow.
I'm just going to let you go into this.
Oh, this is fun. Okay, let's do a quick timeline here because really, honestly, like more seriously, this I think really is where Dan's extremism ramps up and turns dangerous here. So in March 1982, Dan files to run for county sheriff. This is in Utah County. This is real. Then in May 1982, we see kind of a platform statement from Dan. Quote, his platform is based on returning to fundamental constitutional principles. He believes very strongly that the Constitution of our country can protect the rights of individuals and the family, and that any present suffering results from ignorance of this God-inspired document. He believes strongly in the individual's rights of owning and bearing arms, ownership and control of property, protection against unlawful invasion of privacy, and trial by jury or due process. In this statement, Dan also notes that this was important enough that he would actually lay aside his actual job as a chiropractor to be the sheriff. Then, 2 weeks after that, in May 1982, his filing gets thrown out for a very on-brand reason. You see, candidates had to pay a $300 filing fee, not overly unusual. Dan instead gives them a promissory note to be taken from money on account. He then launches into a long, very tangled rant about how the Constitution mandated that courts have to have accounts of actual gold and silver, and the Utah County Court, of course, was not doing that. And Dan was pissed that they threw out his filing, and then he naturally files a lawsuit on constitutional grounds. And this is interesting. Allen is the co-signer on this lawsuit. He then files more lawsuits because the county wouldn't take this promissory note for registering his car also. I can just imagine the internal dialogue in the clerk's head every time one of the Lafferty's walked in. Oh, sweet Mother Mary, here come the Lafferty's again. What this time? Okay, a few months later, October 1982. You can feel the train swaying. It's about to go off the rails here. October 4th, 1982. Dan is coming back from a speaking engagement, and as he would later tell it, he feels like the cops set a trap for him. He gets pulled over on the freeway for speeding. At this point, the speed limit on the freeway was 55, which is just wild. And he, of course, doesn't ever pay attention to his speedometer because speed limits aren't constitutional. That's, if you ever ask Dan why he does something, it's because it's constitutional or unconstitutional.
Can I talk about this scene for a minute? Because I actually, when we speak of the level of research, I had to research this route that he went on and who we talked to. And there is an interview with one of the highway patrolmen later on, you know, after all the dust settles, about his experience with it. I mean, it was a whole thing. And it was interesting because they actually, I think they do have the train tracks in the show because he crosses the train tracks at some point. It's this whole route. So just a fun little aside, I researched that scene.
We'll spoil a little bit because it does appear, but you have to hear this. So there are four separate stops. He gets pulled over initially for speeding. He has a choice. He can sign a voluntary summons to appear in court, or he can be arrested. Dan, of course, knows that a cop issuing a summons, not somebody from the county, is unconstitutional. So of course he's not gonna do that. So He just drives away. They stop him again. Dan takes off again. Dan is weaving in and out of lanes on I-15. Eventually, he will shut down the entire freeway because of this. The next stop, Dan just suddenly throws in reverse, goes through this little pit, and then gets away again. The next time, the cop's had enough. So he's got his window down just enough to talk to the cop. The cop tries to rip the window out of its tracks so he can handcuff him. Dan drives off with a cop stuck in the window.
Hashtag Dan for sheriff.
Amazingly, the cop doesn't get run over in all of this somehow. And then Dan, what's so wild is he eventually stops his car in his own, gets out, and a witness says he's just running up the freeway screaming, "Help me, help me." This is your county sheriff.
Here's the thing, too. Here. So there... It sounds nuts, but there were a lot of people that supported him. They saw him as this sort of maverick badass that was taking on the government. You know, this is, he's using Mormon doctrine to justify this at this point, and it's working against a lot of people, but it's also bothering a lot of people. If you read the op-eds in the newspapers at the time, there are so many angry people. They're like, this guy needs to settle down. So there was definitely a political struggle at the time.
If the Daily Herald in Provo is thinking you're a little too much, that's not a good sign. Yeah, hold the op-eds and letters to the editor in your head for just a second here. Because if you thought that this little episode was fun, wait till we go to trial. It's a jury trial. Dan, of course, is like, there's women on the jury? No, there's not going to be women on my jury. He then tries to argue constitutional law, and the judge says, sir, this is an Arby's. We don't do constitutional law in here. We're just trying to argue your freaking traffic tickets here, bud. Then the people at the trial try to do citizen's arrests on the judge, the prosecutor, and the court clerk. And just for good measure, Dan tells the judge, quote, do justice in the name of Christ or be struck down. This whole scene is wild. And we get, fantastically, we get a letter to the editor about this from someone who is there who tries to put a good face on this. And it's just fantastic. And Dan will actually, because he's still running for sheriff, mind you, at this point, he has not.
This is a real good campaign strategy, buddy.
Wow. And thanks to the papers of the time, we have just fantastic coverage of this. On a little more serious note, we get some really interesting insights into how the brothers are thinking by this point. Now, remember, this is only 1982. We've still got a couple years to go before things really ramp up. So remember, this is very early. We still have a couple years to go. This is before Brenda even comes on the scene, as I recall. So in one article, it notes how the other brothers told the reporter that, quote, Dan will go to any length to save the U.S. Constitution from communism. Now, of course, this statement does not come out of a vacuum. This harkens back to Ezra Taft Benson, the John Birch Society. This is a long history within Mormonism and in the larger American history. Tim tells the newspaper, quote, my brother knows only LDS priesthood holders can save the Constitution. So we'll get some white horse prophecy and Constitution hanging by the thread here. And so knowing that, that dialogue in the series with Robin at the jail probably seemed a little over the top. Guess what? It 100% wasn't. If they're doing this kind of stuff in court, in public, you can be sure if they're in private, it's going to be possibly even wilder. I thought it was fascinating that after all of this, the leader of the PUF group, the Patriots United for Freedom, is like, whoa, 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 Dan's not us. Dan is definitely not
us. When you radicalize that out of a radical anti-tax group, you're going a little far.
That's a feather in your conservative cap there. And again, though, this probably sounds wildly extreme. It's not. Dan is 100% not an outlier. Here we go. Letters to the editor come in supporting Dan in this. One of these talked about, quote, man-made laws to put us in bondage to the secret combination Gadianton robber system that is so prevalent among us. I know another one. People are like, they're not going to be talking about Gadianton robbers. Yes, they were.
I've talked about this before, but this is not funny. This is like a shameful story. But when Rocky Anderson, the Gentile mayor of Salt Lake City, was trying to, get gay marriage legalized or civil unions, I can't even remember. I just remember I was a young married woman, very young, and wrote him a letter about the doctrine of why it was wrong, trying to reason with him using scripture, not even understanding that this man doesn't believe what I believe. And years later, I went and apologized to him personally because we're friends now. But yeah, I did that. I did that for something awful. And, you know, hopefully all my LGBT friends know that, you know, my life's record has been in sort of an atonement of that. But yeah. This is what we do. We write letters to the editor to support this stuff, and we use crazy scripture to do it.
If you think that they didn't invoke the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants in these letters, you would be wrong.
Or in the courtroom, or in the bedroom, or in the living room, or in the chapel all the time.
Remember, in this story, nothing is more over the top than reality. Now, this is another idea that I thought was interesting, and this also is something that her sisters have talked about, is that as these discussions with the brothers start to intensify, Brenda holds her own. She apparently had a very good grasp of LDS doctrine, scriptures, history, and so she wasn't just going to sit down and take it. She fought back verbally.
As is her right. I mean, I know a lot of Mormon women. I've been in discussions with men. I remember being at Utah State, and these return missionaries would come and say these ideas, and I'd be like, that's not true. And they'd be like, yes, it is. The scriptures, blah, blah, blah. And I would say, well, what about this scripture? Like, it was our right as women, you know? There were some of us that grew up like Brenda did, who thought that we had a right to speak, and
such
unfortunately
radicals.
I know, how dare us.
It's funny because it's not funny, but it's not the norm, and so when it does happen, it does stand out, which is a bit of an indictment, I would say.
Yeah.
And so obviously the backdrop and the flashback that corresponds to this is Mormonism becoming more militant in the 1830s. So the end of Kirtland and Missouri now. And as we've talked about, the shift that initially Joseph Smith is kind of getting after Brigham Young for being too militant, but then takes his own shift. That becomes a little more violent in his rhetoric. And then we get to another very fascinating historical flashback of the attempted assassination of Lilburn Boggs, which of course we did an entire episode about because it's very important. Talk about how that scene was structured.
Listen, Mormons, I may have shown the temple. I might have sold my signs and tokens for money, but I got to help avenge the blood of the prophets over and over. I got to be there while we shot Boggs over and over again. I got his blood on my jacket. All right. So I feel like it all evens out when all is said and done. Yes, we did show the assassination attempt of Governor Boggs. There are a few differences to how it really was. Governor Boggs was there with his daughter and his wife at the time in his room. I do believe they had actors on hand to show that, and we ended up just showing him at his desk. His office was bananas. Like, the historical level of research that everyone did, the props department was insane. We had letters from his papers, which I helped research, on his desk that would have been on his desk, addressed to.
Can you see those enough to?
No. Now, okay. I mean, let me show you what I got right here.
I know you've shown me the newspaper.
We found several newspapers in Missouri that he would have had on his desk at the time. I've got one right here. This one's actually a little bit anachronistic. It shows
up. Tell the people the title because it's just so
this funny. This shows up in the 1840s, a little bit after this scene. But this is called The Boonslick Times, Payette, Missouri, Saturday, April 30th, 1842. So it's a little bit after the fact, but the props people let me take that because they know how nerdy I am about this stuff.
If only you would have done some research, Lindsay.
So, yes, we shot Governor Boggs. Porter Rockwell did it. Now, deep breath, Mormon historians and Mormon nerds and Porter Rockwell sycophants. We cannot prove that Porter Rockwell shot Governor Boggs, but Governor Boggs was sure enough that it was him that he issued a warrant, and it for sure was insinuated and probably was.
Was there Porter another Rockwell. Good candidate? Not really. Again, if this
did someone brag possibly about doing it later? Mm-hmm.
You want more on this, remember, an entire episode is waiting for you about this.
Yes, yeah, so you can go back and listen to the Sensone Mormon History podcast that Brian and I have done on this. But yes, we showed it, and it was a different gun. It would have been a shotgun, not a pistol. Again, artistic license. We wanted to see Porter's eyes. Fun fact about the show, the actor who plays Porter is a descendant of the real Porter Rockwell. Even though he's a Gentile now, he came on the non-Mormon line. He does have a farm in Missouri, which I think makes him Mormon at this point.
If you see him walking around and he has some notches in his gun, That's probably not a good sign.
So I got to help cast the historical team, and the casting for Porter Rockwell was such a wild experience. I can't even tell you what that was like. I really wish, I probably can't talk about, I wish I could talk about some of their performances. But yeah, it was funny because Governor Boggs, I can't even remember what happened with the actor, but this ended up being one of our background actors who fills in for Governor Boggs, and he was just great. So you can see a picture of me on Facebook standing covered in like fake Governor Boggs blood, being like, I did it. And that day, it was the weird Mormon in me was coming out. That was like the very last scene we ever shot on the historical thing. And I was just like, get him, Missouri, get him. We're going to take Missouri down. By the end of it, I was so Mormon. I was just like, we're here. This is Missouri. This guy is the biggest villain in Mormon history. Our people have been taught to like curse and spit on his grave for generations. And here I am. And we're going to kill him over and over and over, which is, it sounds terrible. We didn't really kill him. It was an assassination attempt.
It's a metaphor.
It's a metaphor. Yeah. I shouldn't even be that, because it's so bizarre and strange, but it really was like this. It was the end of the series. We'd worked so hard. We had just shot Hans Mill that morning.
Got to celebrate.
I was
with
like
Boggs.
Ready to get rid of Boggs. It was like, that's it. We are taking revenge. That's how it happens, Mormons. Slippery slope.
Revenge is Lindsay's, and she took a little. Now, this is another one that I think has irked a few, is the level of kind of official church collusion or interference in the case. Do we have any evidence of that in the real case going on?
We do. So there was an instantaneous attempt to dissociate from fundamentalists, right? Like the church already knew the Lafferty's were a problem, an increasing problem. And so when this happened, there was this fear that it would make the church look bad. This happened. This is not unprecedented. This happens a lot in cases like this. The phrase that I've heard bishops tell me, you know, when they've been involved in cases like this is, at the end of the day, it was always about protecting the integrity of the church. That's the phrase. And so that absolutely happened here. You can see it in the papers. In fact, they didn't use the term in Utah County or in church newspapers hardly ever. Fundamentalists didn't show up. The Salt Lake Tribune uses the term fundamentalist. They use the term cultist in the
that's
papers.
That's a good Marky Peterson.
I know.
That's a throwback.
Satanic,
I like
panic
that.
Time. Yeah. So there was a hesitancy to even call it that because that association was too close. So that was part of the issue. In Brenda's letters and her journal, she talks about reaching out to church members. She does write a letter. We can get into all of that later, like to the general authorities. But more of that is true than people realize because there was an area authority that she was working with. She was sent back. She was basically told it's your calling to protect the family. And she definitely, if you read her letters, she definitely felt like it was her spiritual role. And I can totally understand that, because how many women out there in that series I talked about in Year of Polygamy, where people are talking about it, women feel it's a responsibility to keep their husbands in line and their faith in line. We're taught to do that.
And the failure, if it happens, is theirs primarily.
Yeah. And so Brenda, you know, she was going to save her family. When you marry into a family, it's eternal. Divorce is not an option. And so for her to even help Diana suggest it shows how dire the situation must have been, because Brenda wasn't about to do that. She was going to fight for her family. And she did.
And what's so wild is knowing that divorce was at least mentally more of an option in Brigham Young's time.
Oh,
than,
I know.
And then at this point.
Yeah, that's probably the cult of family that comes after World War II. And you've got Spencer Kimball, which is the era that these guys lived in, which was very family centered in probably a way that wasn't healthy.
And then this is toward the end of the episode, as they are wont to do, ramp up that tension. We get a hint that there is a list of folks that are being targeted. And this is, of course, the infamous removal revelation that's being discussed. And we talked a little bit about this in the first episode, where Bob Crossfield Onias had a revelation that talked about the idea of other members of the School of the Prophets could also have revelations, but that they needed to be brought to the school and then discussed and kind of ratified there. And of course, that's exactly what happened, is Ron has this revelation of others, not just Brenda and Erica, at the baby, but others that needed to be removed. And we'll probably talk more about this, but that's just an incredibly, and that's that, I know there's been some pushback that this case was simply a domestic violence and revenge case that had no religious elements to it. And that part right there, I think, pushes back on that idea.
I mean, I can understand the case because I do think it's true. And I've seen many, many times over that men use religion to justify their domestic violence, their failure, their internal rage. But that's what makes it, I mean, we use religion to mask all kinds of feelings and emotions. That's what it does. So I can see that argument. But in this case, Dan absolutely puts it in a revelation, still to this day maintains God told him to do it, believes that it was from the Book of Mormon.
And that it was right.
And that it was right, and that God still has a plan to, you know, and that he's Elijah and he's going to bring this in the second coming. Like that, you don't get more religious than that. And again, it's like Joseph Smith marrying women. Did he use religion to justify that? He absolutely did.
And it's not a similar an thing. Or.
I just think that argument was taken out of context. There was an article in Desert News that quotes Sharon, who's a sister, a family member. She's been very generous with her opinions in the group, and she's clarified that statement, you know, that they argued in court that it wasn't religion, because to do that, then you can hide behind religious protection laws. This was ultimately a domestic violence thing. It happened between families, violence between families, and religion was still used. So it's a complicated argument, but it's also very common in Mormon violence that Mormon rhetoric is used. And people will say, well, that doesn't make it Mormon. Violence is everywhere, right? But we do it in a Mormon way.
You mean like using the term fornication in a weird way?
Well, you talked about this before, two episodes ago.
The first one, yeah, with Christina. Yeah, because that comes up, and of course that the Tob and Pyre are both like, wait, so Brenda was sleeping around, as they were talking about? He's like, No. I mean, fornication is not listening to your priesthood holder kind of thing. And they're like, oh, so not fornication then.
And you can see, because mainstream would be like, what? That's not how we use fornication. You can see Jeb in that being like, I've never heard of that before.
And as we talked about, that has a very specific genesis. First from Onias, but of course that's being taken from language in the Peacemaker that we'll talk about. So you can draw a straight line from Nauvoo era thought to the Lafferty brothers. I mean, just thick black line directly through.
Yeah, well, like I said, we'll talk about Peacemaker. You should actually interview Moroni Jessup for that.
That would be fun. And then another idea that comes up is Sam brings up the idea of somebody being in outer darkness, which is another one of those that to a non-Mormon listener probably was very confusing. So in the Mormon cosmology, you've got 3 degrees of glory that are increasingly better. You've got a telestial, a terrestrial, and a celestial kingdom, the celestial being the analogous to God. But then on the side, you've got this outer darkness, which is, I mean, there's certain criteria. People that prefer in and out to other places, I think, is one.
What is it with in and out with you?
BYU fans. I mean, there's...
Animal style fries are the best.
You know, people that watch Friends, I this is a lot of people that end up there. But so when he says someone being in outer darkness, that's like, not just bad. It's like someone, and the way Mormons conceive is that you had to be exposed to the greatest light and then turn from it kind of thing.
But only if you're a dude.
But only dudes.
Because that's the one benefit. This is a true story. I had a Mormon man tell me how blessed I was that mm-hmm. even if I sinned against the Holy Ghost, yep. I was lucky that I wouldn't go to outer darkness. And I was like, do you know what my heaven is supposed to look like, buddy? Like, my highest degree, my best bet is to be a wife of some guy's harem. So settle down. Outer darkness, total annihilation, or being married to my ward clerk for the rest of eternity. I don't know.
I've heard in outer darkness you can turn the volume up on your music more, so maybe there's something. So anyways, that's another one of those elements that kind of is meant to show that the way that they are thinking about this whole thing is a very specific Mormon flavored kind of way.
I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle.
Jingle, jangle.
As I go riding merrily along.
Jingle, jangle.
And they sing, oh, ain't you glad you're single?
Jingle, jangle.
And that song ain't so very far.
As they're discussing this list, we get a couple names. We mention Chloe Lowe and Stowe. And so those are kind of left as cliffhangers, because clearly, and this is, you know, this applied more to the actual day they did it, but this could have been much, much worse. And they intended it to be much, much worse and just kind of happenstance turned out not to be.
I can't wait till we get to episode 7 where we can talk about Chip Carnes and those guys, because those actors are so fun. I got to go to a blues bar with them and they're perfect for the roles. That's all I can say. But I don't want to make light of it because it really is, you know, this list, the gravity of it is kind of terrifying. And we're going to see hints of that. But the show doesn't really go into the depth of the list. This was a revenge killing in that way. You know, it's absolutely true. Anyone that helped assist in getting these women away from these dangerous men were targets. And remain targets for a long time.
And it kind of reminded me, this was had overtones of like the LeBaron, Irva LeBaron hit list too. And obviously they were, I don't know, successful list, is the word you want.
So this is another fundamentalist sect that had a murderous revelation list. And that list remained active to what, 2013? Is that what they said?
Long time.
Yeah. And, you know, Ben Schaefer just talked about it when you're polygamy with me. He was on a list with a different fundamentalist guy. We like our revelations. And depending on the mental health and well-being and trauma, unchecked trauma and cultural landscape and patriarchal beliefs of someone depends on how kind or how cruel those revelations are. And usually a guy that believes that strongly in his own revelations, it's not turning out so well. Well, anything else we want to talk about with three?
Kind of a grim ending.
The show is grim. It's hard because we're talking about this and we're making light of some of it, but we want to hit it home that this is a real murder at the end of the day. You know, it was hard with the Murder Among the Mormons documentary that came out, because in some ways it's this true crime, like, you know, when you listen to true crime podcasts, My Favorite Murder, that, you know, they're laughing and
it's escapist. Which is so weird.
Well, I think it's just a way to deal with the darkness. Humor is a way to deal with that. And I think it's a legitimate way. But in our community, it's small enough that everybody knows someone who is involved. And we're not just talking about the victims of the murder, but of course that too. But there are people that knew some of the people in School of the Prophets whose dads were involved, who went to school with these folks. I know I just heard about a young lady who was named after Erica Lafferty. You know, it's like this has implications. And so I want to pay some reverence to that and remind everyone out there, too, that when we're talking about it, even though we have a stake in this, especially as Mormons, we want to argue about our faith and the politics involved in this. At the end of the day, it still had higher stakes for very real people. I beg you, spill my blood, oh, brother young. And let it smoke us into heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, brother Young. Let only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young. The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by artist Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.